It is Your Money. I'm Susie Jones, back in the saddle after a couple of weeks off. Happy to have you with us. Right out of the gates, want to remind you, if you have any questions today or after the show, whenever you want, you can call 1-888-6-ADVICE and talk to folks at Wealth Enhancement. You can also text a question, or you can email questions to yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com. Now, though, here is the founder of Wealth Enhancement, financial advisor Bruce Helmer, and Senior Vice President and Financial Advisor Peg Webb. Hello to both of you guys. Hope everybody's doing well.
Hey, Susie. Hey, Peg. The band is back together again. Good to be with you both again.
Thank you.
Peg, because Susie Peg was also gone the last 2 weeks, so
Oh, boy. It's
nice to be with you both. Yeah, it's nice to be with you both again. And so, Susie and listeners, Peg today and I are going to talk about something that people really, frankly, don't like to talk about, but it's really important that we do. We're going to talk about what we're calling end-of-life care planning. In addition to, you know, making sure that we help those that we love die with dignity, there can be financial issues, financial concerns at end of life. And Peg, you know, maybe the logical place to start with this is how I kind of already introduced the topic, that people don't like to talk about this. America is really a death-denying culture. We don't like to think about it. We don't talk about it. We don't even acknowledge that death is inevitable intellectually somewhere. We know we're going to die, but we think if we just avoid it and don't talk about it and don't worry about it, like maybe it's not going to happen or something, but it's going to happen to all of us. So maybe that's our starting point, that this culture, this sense of we don't want to deal with this because we run into it all the time. Peg?
All right, we might have to reconnect Peg, Bruce, because we went to her and didn't hear anything, so we'll take that. But you're right about that. Nobody does like to think about death, and it's very important to do so, right? I mean, you learn so many about so many difficult things if you're not prepared, right?
Well, and yes, Susie, and that's a great point. Thank you for taking the baton from me. We don't like to talk about death and confront death. Now, you combine that with the fact that we also culturally, many people, don't like to talk about money. That seems to be a taboo topic. And so a lot of families, they haven't spoken about their personal financial situation. They haven't, communicated anything to their adult children. So you take this denial about our own mortality, and you combine it with the fact that everybody's uncomfortable, or most people are uncomfortable talking about money, and we're combining these two things that people want to avoid and not talk about, and here come Peg and I and, you know, financial advisors or Wealth Enhancement Group saying, hey, we really need to talk about these things, and people really resist this. I understand we have Peg back?
Yes, we do. Hi, Peg.
Yeah. And I think
hi, Peg.
Sorry about that. I think. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yes.
Oh, good. Okay. Because I was online and then I got dropped off. Okay. So I'm not quite sure what you talked about, Bruce, but part of it was denial can be a coping mechanism, managing your emotions and situations. And then did you talk about the cost of dying?
No, I didn't even get to that yet. All we talked about, Peg, is, first of all, I said it's good to be with you both again. The band is back together.
Yeah,
you and Susie
yeah.
both had the last couple of weeks off. But I said we're combining two topics that people would really rather not talk about. They don't want to talk about dying. And even before they get to that point, most people don't want to talk about money, even to loved ones, to their adult kids, and sometimes to each other as spouses or couples or partners. So we're taking these two things that people don't want to talk about, and you and I are saying, hey, we want you to talk about these two things.
Yeah, and really, most people don't think about the cost of dying. Well, number one, we don't want to think about it at all. We're just that you mentioned that already, Bruce, in the beginning, is that we're a society that would rather just wait until something happens to deal with it. But the cost of dying, being financial advisors, we need to take that into consideration. So this couple stats are that the cost of the last 3 months of care in a hospital is like $56,000. Now, a lot of health insurance or Medicare will pay for some of that, but then there's hospice, which is close to $18,000 per month, and then there's funeral costs. So we talk to our clients about, are you prepared? You know, do you have that particular day kind of set up, because it's hard on families, and that's what we see on the backside. There's also costs of accountants and paying bills, and a lot of times that's a burden on the family. Then there's legal fees, a lot of times with looking at the trust or the estate, you know, and dividing all the assets, disposing of the real estate. And then I have to throw in here, it's not in our outline, but like I'm one of seven kids. So what we witness is there's a little bit of bickering and who's going to do what, and it's after the fact. Like, that should be something that's already decided. Who's taking the lead? Maybe you split up the duties. Because a lot of times settling the assets and divvying it up to the children takes a year and a half or so, and a lot of people think, I want that money next week. Like, I was counting on that. And so that's very difficult on the particular sibling that might be the lead in trying to figure that out. And I've actually witnessed siblings not talking to one another for decades of time because of it. So we strongly suggest that people talk about it before it happens. Bruce?
Peg, you are so darn, excuse me, you are so darn smart, and this is why I miss you when you're not here. What you just brought up is so critical, so crucial. I've seen it so many times. I've lost count. I've been doing this over 40 years, but the number of families that have told me their family will never fight about money, they love each other, they got that everything's going to be fine, that end up fighting and bickering about money that thought they never would, I've totally lost count. So I didn't even think about that not being in the outline, but that is absolutely a critical component of this end of life thing that we're talking about. And I think we can help families avoid some of that discomfort, avoid some of that adversarial, situation, avoid some of that conflict just with planning. I think a lot of the frustration and anger and disagreement happens because nobody planned for it, nobody talked about it, and now you find yourself in the middle of the situation, and everybody's stressed out, and everybody's got their own goals and ulterior motives. And we can avoid a lot of that if we would just plan before we get there. So that is such a good point. I'm so glad you thought of that. I wouldn't have thought of it. Peg?
There's a couple other reasons that the end of life, but not, let's take a step back before the end of life happens. We have progressive disability. So Bruce, you and I watch our clients, and since we've been in this for so long, they're probably looking at us too going, geez, they're starting to look kind of old. But they're starting to come up with, you know, and I'd say earlier than before, a transition of housing. So if you're in your big home, and a lot of, you know, older people have lived there for decades of time, they don't want to leave their home. That has to kind of be a joint effort too with siblings, or if there's somebody that actually is the leader there as well. Do you move into an apartment or an assisted living or something like that? That's the first sign of kind of people wanting to share their net worth with their siblings. See, we are a society of really zipping it up. We don't want to share what we have because then we feel like our children are going to say, oh, I can't wait to get that. Or, you know, they're already counting that as part of their financial plan. So we find that when it comes up to where the disability starts to we're witnessing that, then we kind of get those kids involved. And then the need for servicing or the services that you need with a disability or something are very expensive. And so in our financial plans, we try to incorporate that in, how the cost of your living is going to become higher. And then some families, quite frankly, people are living so long that they deplete their savings. And then then they may go on Medicaid or something like that to be able to live for the rest of their life. So these are, bottom line, these are very emotional times. And once again, I always say that I wish I had a psychology degree. Now I actually wish I had a social services degree, because we deal with that too, with the family members and our clients and the professional caregivers trying to coordinate all of that for the family. Bruce?
So a couple of thoughts, and again, all good stuff, Peg. You know, I just want to go back, and yes, I have encountered many times in my 40-plus year career of family squabbling over money, but I also have to say that I think the vast majority of my clients, the adult children and the families that I work with, are such that the kids say, look, mom and dad, you travel, you enjoy this money, we're not counting on this inheritance, we don't need this inheritance. So usually I do get a very gracious, very selfless attitude within families. But again, a lot of people over a lot of years, I've also seen it go south and go the other way. But the other thing, you brought up something really important. We're talking about, it really, again, end-of-life care planning. And I think a lot of people, one of their biggest fears, well, almost everybody, their biggest fear when they retire is that they might run out of money before they run out of breath. And one of the reasons that people might cite for that or fear that is because even if they've done a good job of saving and investing, even if at retirement they're living within their means, an extended stay in some sort of healthcare facility because of that extreme cost can, deplete someone's assets pretty quickly. And then all these years of working and hoping and having a legacy plan for loved ones goes away because all the money goes into that extended, care situation. So that is a reality, and that is something that we deal with. But again, it's something that we can try to plan for before we end up in that situation. Peg?
I should clarify, too, that when I'm talking about these kids, you're going to laugh at this, Bruce and Susie, but I mean, we're talking about the clients that are 85 and the kids are 65, right? So, I mean, we're not talking about when I say kids or, children or something like that. A lot of times they are, in their 50s or 60s. And so when you take that into context, they are able to, the family members are able to help. And I would agree with you, Bruce, that especially like this transition into a different facility, like from your house to assisted living, and lots of times they're kicking and screaming, they don't want to go. But guess what? I would say 80% of the time they're delighted because they have all these new friends and activities that they can do. And I think I actually believe, just in witnessing this, they prolong their life because it's just another component of almost like a new friendship or a new era in their life. Bruce?
Yeah, I see the same thing, Peg, and I understand. I think all of us, to some degree or another, are afraid of change. And so I think that's the biggest thing. People don't want to change the life that they've been accustomed to for so long. But I agree with you, Peg. Once they realize the inevitability and they can't, live alone anymore, and they accept it, they get there and they end up enjoying it and making new friends. And there's social activities, there's a community of people, and they do end up actually liking it. But I understand that it's a hard transition for them to deal with. So we've talked about, Peg, a lot of these costs. We've talked about a lot of the emotion. We've talked about nobody wants to talk about this, and here we are talking about it. But we also keep saying plan for it before you get there. There's things that we can do to mitigate, some of the costs that you're looking at, some of the battles or squabbles that you might have when you get there. Let's talk a little bit about some of the legal considerations, some of the planning documents that people should have in place before they get into this situation. Peg?
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. So when we meet with clients or prospective clients right away, we're also reviewing what documents do you have for your estate. So a couple things. One being a will, so your primary estate planning document. And all that is it's saying the things that I have, here's how I would like it to be taken care of or given to. So it's a document that lays out your assets when you die and assures that your estate is distributed correctly, like to the people that you want to get your assets. And we highly recommend don't put off creating a will, because later in life, it's actually, I think, more difficult, and you can always change it. So this is a document that you can change. And a lot of times there are life circumstances that you want to change it because of marriage, and maybe there's a different birth of a child if you're younger, and a death of the beneficiary, and maybe you retire and you want to change things. I find that even as I get older, my thoughts and convictions of things that I want to do are changing. And so keep that in mind. A power of attorney is really important because it designates someone to step in and manage your finances. So there's a couple different kinds of power of attorney, a general one that just designates someone to act on your behalf, and then a limited, just like it sounds, it designates someone to act on your behalf only in specific matters or events. Probably the big one here, Bruce, is the healthcare advance directive. That's something where you it works a lot like the power of attorney, but it's an important difference. The healthcare advance directive is actually medical decisions versus financial decisions. So you do need both. And that I would say that's probably the most misunderstood document. I also have a lot of clients that want to name all their children like on a medical decision document, which let's just say you're in the hospital and you're not doing well and you've got seven kids, like I'm one of seven. And I've witnessed this, that we can't all agree, right? So normally you would probably want to get one or maybe two of your children on that document because that can actually delay some kind of a health treatment that you need. Then lastly, here is the beneficiary designations. We talk about this all the time, Bruce, on the show, that you need to, on your assets, make sure that there's someone named that would be as a beneficiary, or you have stated that in your will or that I talked about earlier. And then trusts. We talk a lot about trusts, and we talk about the differences of wills and trusts. And all it is a will is something that you would implement when you die, but a trust is something that you would implement earlier, and it's an entity that'll direct where all your assets go. And you don't have to really, you don't have to, but a lot of clients do go back to that legal attorney to go through their trust. But it's very well documented as to what you want to happen to your assets. And let me just add one more point. There is a revocable trust. So you can, even though that trusts kind of scare people in some ways, you can change what's in your trust if it's revocable. Many people hear about irrevocable trusts, and when you make decisions in an irrevocable trust, you actually cannot change them. And so that's a big decision that you need to make, although I feel like it, in some cases, it's a great idea to have an irrevocable trust because it literally takes those assets and it takes it off your taxable estate when you die. So people who have accumulated a lot of wealth may look at an irrevocable trust as something for tax planning at death. Bruce?
Yeah, so Peg, if I counted correctly, as we went through these essential documents, I came up, I think you had five. You said a will, a power of attorney, a healthcare advance directive, and then having beneficiary designations on your investments, on your retirement plan, on your life insurance, on your bank account. And then you talked about trusts. And so that's five. Peg, some of the questions I get, sometimes someone will say, well, if I have beneficiaries named on all my investments, why do I need a will? And the other one I get a lot is, when do I need a trust as compared to a will? And I'll answer the first part of it, and then I'll let you jump in. And we've got about a minute or so left. But people that don't have a will generally also then aren't going to have a power of attorney and a healthcare advance directive. And because the lawyers that we work with, if we send a client to get their legal documents done, the attorney, when they draft the will, is automatically going to also then draft the POA, the power of attorney, and the healthcare advance directive. And those are important that people have those. Last thought, and when we come back after the break, Susie, we'll finish up the discussion and get listeners involved, and we'll talk a little bit about investable assets before people get into the getting close to death. But Peg, when a trust versus a will?
Yeah, I think it's about the complexity and with a trust having it done ahead of time. Like a will is something that is, I would say it's more simplistic, but a trust defines in more detail what you want. And then kind of the difference too is the cost. So a will is a little bit cheaper to get done than a trust. And so some people say, oh, I don't want to pay for that now. But guess what? At the end of life, you'll probably have some more costs in going through maybe possibly probate or having an attorney go through that will, where a trust, you may not have to do that.
All right.
Susie?
Yep, 651-461-9226. A lot of people with questions already about this. We're back after this. And welcome back to the second half of Your Money. The number to call if you have a question for Bruce or Peg right now, 651-461-9226. Once again, here is the founder of Wealth Enhancement Group and financial advisor Bruce Helmer and senior vice president and financial advisor Peg Webb. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you, Susie Jones. Peg Webb, good to be with you again this week. Susie, good to be with you also. Listeners, if you joined us late, Peg and I have been talking about end-of-life care planning, and we talked about how we try to sweep this topic under the rug. Nobody likes to talk about getting old and dying, and even though it's inevitable and we know it's going to happen, we try to avoid it. And then you combine that with the fact that most people don't like to talk about money. And Peg and I come in and say we want to talk about money and, you know, the end of life situation and put these things together, and because they're important. We talked about that a lot of times families have stress and disagreements and anxiety when a loved one finds themselves in these situations. It can cause hardship within the family. And we believe that a lot of this can be avoided just with planning. So we started to talk about some of the planning. We talked about wills. We talked about a power of attorney. We talked about a healthcare advance directive. We talked about having beneficiary designations on your various retirement plans, insurances. And by the way, check those from time to time, because over the years, I've run into a lot of people that didn't realize that sometimes on accounts they thought they had a beneficiary designation and they didn't, or sometimes they had a beneficiary, but it's not who they wanted it to be because life happened. Somebody passed away, somebody got sick, there was a divorce, whatever. So make sure you update and check your beneficiary designations. And then we also talked about trusts, and a lot of people, a trust is going to be an appropriate document to help protect assets and talk about the distribution. Because again, a lot of this gets into legacy planning. Most of us are not going to spend our last dollar the day we take our last breath. So whatever is left, where do we want it to go? And how do we get it there efficiently and effectively to our loved ones? But now, Peg, let's segue. So we talked a lot about this kind of end of life stuff. But again, before we get there, we should talk a little bit about proper investing and how you invest differently after retirement as opposed to before retirement, when we're probably, most of us are focusing on growth and, you know, growing our money to have a bigger nest egg so that when we do retire, we can draw on that money to replace our paycheck and fund our lifestyle. But when we get retirement years and beyond, how we do that investing can and should change. Let's talk a little bit about how we work with clients to do that efficiently and effectively. Peg?
Yeah, we talk often on this show about the Your Money Matrix. And the Your Money Matrix is a document that actually dissects how your assets are taxed and how risky they are. And so this is perfect for planning and for later in life, you know, going into assisted living or maybe you need some home health care or that kind of thing. And Bruce, you mentioned going from maybe a little bit riskier to maybe a little bit more conservative. This document considers your taxable accounts where you get a 1099 at the end of the year and you have to put that on your taxes, tax deferred where you have a huge IOU to the IRS, but you're willing to just let it still compound in a deferred account until you take the money out, you won't owe Uncle Sam. Taxed advantaged accounts like Roth IRAs or municipal bonds where they're tax free and possibly tax free when you pull the money out, provided that you follow the rules. Having this kind of guide for our clients and for the beneficiaries of the estate is very helpful, or even while the clients are alive, because it gives a clearer picture of where would we take the money from, you know, for these extra costs by that short term, medium term, and long term. And so I can't highlight enough about just being organized, because on the backside, people will come in and it's just in total disarray. And I have to say, Bruce, I would say that the older you are, now I'm generalizing here, but the older you are, the more you were kind of a pack rat, right? Because I get so many clients asking me, I have kept every statement that you have sent me for the last 25 years. Or I have saved these prospectuses that, you know, I no longer even own this investment. What do I do? So something I would say, Bruce, is everyone listening, if there's a way you could do some cleanup ahead of time, like, you know, and ask your advisor questions. Should I keep this? Shouldn't I keep that? We're starting to really get in a digital world now, too. So we didn't even have this on our list, but the password. You know, to leave a password list of some kind for the beneficiaries, because that that would be very difficult to take care of all that if you don't have access to those. Bruce?
Yeah, and just that's really good, Peg, and I'm glad you brought up the password thing, because that's me. I never have various accounts that I need to get into. I never remember what my password is, and I have to go through a process to reset the password and figure it out again. But going back to investing, and I'm really glad you brought up the Your Money Matrix. All investments are treated one of three ways from a tax standpoint: fully immediately taxable, tax deferred, or tax advantage. And then we break down by time horizon, and we help clients make sure they're always spending the smartest money first. If they've got multiple options on where they can draw money from, we want to make sure they're spending the right money, because if we do that, if we maximize returns, if we minimize taxes, we make that money last as long as possible, or help them make that money last as long as possible, and increase the chances that they have some sort of a legacy for their loved ones. And at the risk of tooting our own horn or sounding self-serving, that type of planning, retirement income planning, helping our clients spend their money and spend it efficiently, I think I can safely say most people in our space don't do that. And that's an important part of the comprehensive financial planning process. Peg, anything else on our topic today? Again, talking about end-of-life care planning. Anything else that you think we should hit or that you think of maybe that wasn't in the outline or was in the outline that you want to expand on? Or any key takeaways for listeners before we get them involved?
Well, I just want to mention, and it is on our outline, that the best way to prepare for a better end-of-life is to stay as healthy as you can. Now, I can't tell you that I'm sitting in front of my clients telling them that they should have a proper diet, regular exercise, sleep at least 7 hours. This is what Mayo Clinic says. Stress management. Don't smoke. Reduce your screen time. Don't have caffeine as much as. Don't have alcohol. Engage with your family and friends. That one I did bring up earlier about maybe going into assisted living or an apartment or something and having new relationships, because I've seen my clients just light up when they made a new friend at their new housing. Bruce?
I'm so glad you brought that up, and that's a great point. And on occasion, we do talk about good health, and I've had people say to me before, what are you doing talking about health? You're a financial person. But anyone that thinks that those two things aren't related is missing the point. It doesn't matter how much money you accumulate, how much money you have. If you're too frail, too sick, too whatever to enjoy it, it's not worth it. These two things go hand in hand. And again, I won't tell you that I live a perfectly healthy life. Anyone that knows what I look like, I probably weigh a little bit more than I should, but it is a priority. And I know it is with you also, Peg. We both exercise. We both try to eat right. We both try to do things to maintain a healthy life and an active lifestyle for as long as we can. And it does make a difference. And it is related to our happiness at retirement and the financial aspects, because if we're healthier, we're going to spend less money on medical things as we get older. We can avoid some of that. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. I didn't just make that up. I've heard that before, and there's a reason why these old colloquial expressions exist, because they're accurate. Peg, last word before we go to listeners?
No, I'm ready for listeners.
All right, that's my cue.
Let's do it, Susie.
All right, 651-461-9226. Texter writes, are there ways to protect our heirs from paying a lot of taxes on our 401ks after we die?
Oh, man, Peg, that is such a great question. And I'll kind of set it up and let you answer first. But to the texter and to listeners, it's really important. And again, I'm still in my fall seminar series, and this is one of the topics I'm talking about. People, when they leave a legacy to loved ones, I don't think they understand that if it's a tax-deferred account, like a traditional IRA or a traditional 401k, the heir or the beneficiary of that account is going to have to pay the taxes on that inheritance at their tax rate. And a lot of people don't think about that. Peg, how do we help them maximize their efficiency or minimize their taxes?
Yeah, well, one of the things I would talk about is just while you're still alive and you're listening to the show and you have lots of tax deferred assets. I talked about this a little bit, the IOU to the IRS. I think we're kind of brainwashed into having the 401k or the IRAs compound for as long as we possibly can until required minimum distribution age happens. But it is a negative in that somebody's going to pay the tax someday. It is true that you make money on money that you otherwise would pay Uncle Sam earlier. That's true. But sometimes it's best to maybe take some of the money out or convert it to Roth IRAs that we talk about on this show. Beneficiaries have some choices that they get to make. It used to be that you could have that 401k or that IRA taken out over your lifetime, which is a very long time for some of these beneficiaries. They came out with new rules that are forcing you to take that money out earlier than later, because the IRS is just saying, wait a minute, we're not collecting the taxes on that for decades of time, and sometimes multiple generations of people. So one of the things that I would tell people listening is, pay attention to your deferred bucket and how big it is, because I also believe that, you know, we are sunsetting with taxes on 1/1/26 if there's no change made before then, and taxes are going to go up. So one of the things you may want to do in the immediate is pull some IRA money out, pay your tax, and have it in an after-tax position versus all this tax deferred. Bruce?
Yeah, so Peg, that you hit the nail on the head, and again, this is part of planning and estate planning or legacy planning, if you will. And occasionally I do get people that say legacy planning isn't important to them. Their kids are doing great and their kids have more money than they have, and their goal is to spend their last dollar the day they take their last breath. And I always say, well, we're so good at planning, we can achieve that goal or objective. We can help you spend your last dollar the day you take your last breath. You just have to tell us exactly when you're going to die. And therein lies the problem. Nobody knows when that is. And so because we have to plan and make sure we don't use up all of our money before we die or try to do that, most people are going to die with something. They're not going to spend their last dollar the day they take their last breath. So even if legacy planning isn't a priority, it's smart and appropriate to do it to maximize that efficiency. Just a really quick example, back to these tax deferred plans, and I like what Peg said. To some extent, you might want to, you know, somebody's going to pay the tax on these, either you or whoever you leave the money to. And that's the first decision. Do you want your kids to pay the tax, or do you want to pay the tax before you leave the money to your kids? But a simple example, let's say you're a parent and you have two children, and your goal is to treat your children equally. But child number one is a very highly compensated surgeon, and they're in a 37% tax bracket, and you leave them $200,000 from a traditional IRA. Well, their tax liability on that at 37% is going to be $74,000. They're going to net $126,000. Child number two is a public school teacher making, and they're in a 12% tax bracket. You want to treat your kids equally, so you leave them each $200,000. But child number two is only going to pay $24,000 in taxes because they're in a much lower tax bracket. They're going to net $176,000 or $50,000 more. Now, a lot of listeners might say, well, so what? Child number two obviously needs help more. So it's fine if they get more net after-tax money. But if your goal as a parent is to treat them equally, you don't want to penalize child one just because they make more money. How do we do planning, legacy planning, so that we even the score and even that out? So this is way more complicated than people realize that it is. And again, I can't emphasize this enough. I think, Peg, a lot of people tune us out when we talk about estate planning because they think of estate taxes, and they're like, my estate's not that big. I'm not going to have estate taxes. But I like the term legacy planning because, again, almost all of us are going to die with something left, and it's important that we get it where we want it to go as efficiently and effectively as we can. So, Susie, that was a great opening text. Thanks.
All right, very good. 651-461-9226. Texter writes, did I hear Peg say hospice care is $18,000 a year? My understanding is that it is covered by Medicare. Can you clarify, please?
Peg, hospice and Medicare supplements and so forth?
Well, hospice was, the outline says that actually it's $17,845 per month.
That's what I thought.
That was 2016 average, and it could actually be higher now. What Medicare, Medicaid pays for, I don't know off the top of my head, but in most cases, people would do their homework to find out how much, would be covered. With my clients, I feel like a lot of it has been covered in the past, but I don't know. I have not personally in my practice seen the stats on that. Bruce, have you?
No, and again, what makes this, I think, Peg and Texter and listeners so confusing is there's so many different types of senior care. It might be in-home health care. It might be adult daycare. It might be a full-time facility. If it is a full-time facility, there's different levels of care. There's memory care and so forth and so on. So it's the cost can really vary based on the level of care. But again, I think, Peg, there's a misconception that because I have Medicare, I'm going to be fine. But Medicare doesn't cover a lot of those costs, which leads people into some sort of Medicare Advantage plan or Medicare supplement plan to cover some of the things that Medicare does not. And even those supplement plans won't cover everything, which gets us into do you want long-term care insurance or not? Now, I'm not going to turn the show and the time we have left into a full-blown discussion of long-term care, but this is why it gets confusing. This is why it's so hard, and this is why planning in advance becomes so important if you want to try to make your assets last as long as possible. Obviously, the duration of time that you need this care can change. Can vary dramatically. For some people, it's days. For other people, it's decades, and there's no way to predict that. So it's very expensive, very confusing, and to get into the precise numbers, I just don't think I know them, nor do we have time. Susie, let's go to another question or caller.
651-461-9226. If your spouse is your power of attorney, is there a way to name a successor power of attorney in the document?
That's such a good question. Peg, talk a little bit about how we work with clients in naming the POA, naming the power of attorney, because again, this is one of the issues that can cause disharmony within a family. Sometimes clients want to name you and I as the POA.
Yeah.
So talk about, you know, how we do that POA, maybe executor of a trust and all those things. How does that, how do the logistics of all this stuff work?
Yeah, well, it is difficult. And once again, most people that we work with have more than one child. So then it gets complicated because a power of attorney, probably the biggest question I get is they name one child and then the client puts that person's name on the checking account, which actually really throws everything into it just throws everything off. So power of attorney is a great idea in that you have somebody designated to take care of all the things. But you can have even more than one. And so you could have two of your children on a power of attorney. I would talk to your legal, attorney about that and just see and make sure that you understand how that all works and how many people you can have on it and who would you select. They usually select the numbers person in the family that would take care of that. Bruce?
Well, and again, this is one of those issues where even doing that, trying to do the right planning, trying to do the right thing can harbor some resentment or jealousy where other people say, why did that kid get named the POA? And I don't trust that person. I mean, where's the money going? Account for this, account for that. So even when we do things right and try to do the planning, there can still be issues or disharmony. But Peg, then the other one that comes up, and it wasn't part of the text, and maybe this is the last thing, we're running out of time again, but if you have a trust, And you're going to name somebody to be the executor of the trust, that's a little bit kind of the same decision. Do you pick the most responsible child? Do you pick the oldest child? How do you see that happening in your world?
Well, I actually see a lot of the oldest child, but the oldest child could be the one that's great at healthcare, help with where to go and all of that. And then there's usually a numbers person, and I tend to agree with a numbers person being the power of attorney than not.
Yeah, I agree. And again, usually it works out pretty well. Occasionally there's still problems, but it's better to do this planning than not do this planning. And Susie, I know that we're almost out of time. We can't dig any deeper today.
Yeah, it's a great topic, though, and a lot of people do leave it till it's too late. All right, again, if you are someone that's had a question and did not get it answered, you can call Wealth Enhancement at 1-888-6-ADVICE. I'll say that once more, 1-888-6-ADVICE, or you can always email your questions to yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com. That's yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com. Make it a great week.